I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation. And it's really a pleasure to be here at this great meeting. I was asked to talk about magnetic shielding, but I decided to tell you a little bit more than just magnetic shielding, of course. To the content of my talk, I will motivate a little bit and tell you why I spend so much time with small magnetic fields. And my main motivation is that I'm interested in performing a next generation electric dipole moment measurement of the neutron. And the neutron electric dipole moment is measured to a precision of 10 to the minus 26 electron centimeters. Yeah, but the microphone, it has a green light here. Yeah, okay, maybe I should talk a little bit louder then. I figured since it's a theory institute, people know what an electric dipole moment is. I had the impression that at least two people were in the audience talking with me who were kind of less familiar with the units and these numbers or so. This means charge times distance. So this is the unit of an electric dipole, and this is resolved to 10 to the minus 26 centimeters for the neutron. This is not the best system, but it's one of the historically more prominent systems, not necessarily the best in terms of parameters that you can extract from it. And by improving this by two orders of magnitude, one has to understand a lot more about the experimental situation, how the measurement is performed. And while we were waiting for more neutrons, we had time to look into systematics a little bit more, actually almost a decade now. One can have an opinion about this, and I talked maybe a little bit about this. So then I will tell you about the status in magnetic shielding and some applications that we found in the meantime. And I give you an update about two electric dipole moment measurement efforts that we are doing or where I'm involved. One is a xenon EDM, and the other one is this neutron EDM that I mentioned from the beginning on. Without giving you any theoretical motivation, since I was told everyone knows this, I just want to point out there are many systems that you can use for electric dipole moment measurements. And the fundamental theory is somewhere far away. Okay? So depending on what system you choose for your measurement, you have to understand different things to learn about the underlying physics. Yeah? So if you make an atomic EDM measurement, you have to know something about the what the atom looks like, then what the nucleus looks like, and so on. Yes, so there are different paths. And what we learn is that the parameters that you can extract from these measurements and the measurements are kind of related with each other. So you have different types of parameters, leptonic EDMs, you have different coupling parameters, tensor and scalar coupling parameters, and some mesonucleon coupling parameters, and different systems for your measurements, paramagnets, polar molecules, diamagnetic atoms, nucleons, fundamental fermions, so always give you some kind of linear combination of these effects. And also there are cases where also effects at higher order are relevant. For example, in the case of Mercury 199, even though, for example, electron EDM is not the most interesting thing that you would measure with Mercury 199, it's still a quantity that you can derive quite well. And another statement that I wanted to make here is, in principle, it's kind of obvious to write down something like a matrix and do a combined analysis. And there is a review coming out, hopefully soon. It's under review here. So there are several neutron EDM measurements ongoing or planned. This is the Rutherford-Sussex ILL measurement, which basically was finished in 2006. And the limit has been reanalyzed for this deeper understanding about systematics, and the approximate limit is 3 times 10 to the minus 26 electron centimeters for this quantity. The experiment is performed at room temperature with trapped ultra-cold neutrons. I will explain a little bit what this is. The apparatus itself is at room temperature, although the particles you trap inside the apparatus are at millikelvin temperature. Then it has a cohabitating magnetometer, Mercury 199. Its supply of neutrons is a reactor in Grenoble. It uses one cell. It has a density of on the order of few neutrons per cubic centimeter in the trap. This is a small number, it immediately tells you if I make a measurement with a polarized noble gas at one atmosphere where you have 10 to the 19 per cubic centimeter, there's a lot of advantage.
Yes. Yes. So can I ask, so Eric, you were telling me that there is a new result in the Mercury EDM, so this is the result you were talking about?
No, these are just neutron EDM measurements.
Co-magnetometer is Mercury.
This is just a reference magnetometer.
These are
really just neutron measurements.
Oh.
And I just wanted to point out here, so this is the only one that actually did something, and all the others here on this list are either measuring or either building, and this table is, I took it from Rüdiger Picker to have him, he's from Triumph, he gave a more recent talk.
Can I ask what RT is? What is RT?
Room temperature. Okay.
Sorry
for this. All these experiments here have numbers that are floating around since I started working in this field approximately. So I just wanted to point out this is the best that we have so far, and all the others actually really need to speed up with progress, because otherwise at some point maybe the proton EDM is faster. The proton EDM has the advantage that the particles come out from a gas bottle instead of a reactor, but there are more experimental difficulties. With the neutrons, a neutral particle is very good to put in a trap. When you would like to apply an electric field, a charged particle immediately flies to your electrode. So the trapping is more complicated to understand this systematically. Yeah, that's why the neutron is still a very prominent system. But if we don't have enough neutrons for our experiments, at some points the proton EDM people will be faster. And I should mention here that this is the density of particles in the trap. You see the goals of the people here. PSI already knows that it doesn't work very much better. We don't know yet how good it will work. And no one else knows. They also don't know, by the way. So everything that... from a calculation, like for all the others who've read on big numbers. That's the problem.
But they are above 100
already, right? In our case, the demonstrator that we based on has 220 demonstrated. Yeah, so that's somewhat promising at least, but we are not there. So we are definitely much higher than this, but we are not there yet. So we have a source that has 220 per cubic centimeter shown. Okay, so I will not talk about all the other experiments, but say a few words about this one a little bit later. Yeah. Maybe some more comments. Yeah, everyone wants to beat the 10 to the minus 27 in the next stage and then go to 10 to the minus 28. Yeah. But it really doesn't make sense to go to the exact dates, because they will all be wrong, like they were in the last 10 years.
Neutron EDM from the Mercury experiment, from observing the Mercury, because...
I don't know if you can. This is one of these things that you cannot easily translate between each other.
I know. Yeah. There's large uncertainty in those matrix elements. So
yeah.
Because you never measure directly the neutron EDM those experiments. Right?
Well, in many cases, the Mercury limit is a much better limit than the neutron limit already.
But
I think including shift suppression and the big problems that you have calculating the shift moment for the specific case of Mercury, even when you include this, it's a better measurement than the neutron in for many parameters. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, the neutron is still a prominent one. It's relatively simple still, because you don't need to calculate all these things. Okay, so how do we measure the neutron electric dipole moment? It's the classical Ramsey experiment, basically I think invented for this purpose. One starts out in a small magnetic field. This is a microtesla, a 50th of the Earth field, okay, homogeneous over the size of the experiment, which is that size approximately. Particles are polarized. Outside of the experiment, there's an oscillator running, stable clock. At some point, the clock is connected with a transverse magnetic field coil, which flips the spins, all of them, the ensemble of spins, the particles that bounce around in the box, all bounce around randomly, but the spins are aligned. When you apply this field, you flip all of them, and then they start precessing coherently for on the order of 100, in the Sussex experiment, 130 seconds, in our case 250. And after a certain time, you apply the same pulse again. And if there's no phase difference between here and here, you can flip the spin downwards. Yeah, so it's in that sense an interferometer in time, if you want, but this is always difficult to say. So the idea is when the Lamar frequency is affected by the presence of an additional electric field, parallel or antiparallel, during this measurement, you found an EDM. Yeah. The way this is measured is by repeating the measurement many times with slight variations of this clock frequency, or more practical, random field drifts that kind of give you the same behavior in the end. So the idea is you basically vary this frequency here, yeah, and then the same point, and then you repeat the measurement with different detunings. That means when you're off by 180 degrees between these two pulses relative to this frequency, the spin would go up instead of down. And this would be the point here and here instead of the point down here. If there's an EDM, this whole curve is shifted. The idea is you go to the point of steepest slope to extract the electric dipole moment that's the most sensitive. So you collect points around here and here. Okay? It works better. The error is smaller. The longer you can make the experiment run here, this time, the larger the electric field is, the more particles you have, 1 over square root of n, and the better the contrast is. This is this parameter alpha here, which tells you if this curve goes from minus 1 to 1 or if it goes from here to here only. Okay? The particles are so-called ultra-cold neutrons. They are a really nice gift of nature. One really has to say this, and it's really very elegant to play with ultra-cold neutrons. One can do a lot of cool things. They have nano-electron-volt energies, yeah, or millikelvin temperatures, if you would assign a temperature to these particles, which don't interact with each other, also because of the small densities, meter per second velocity, or tens of nanometers wavelengths. The wavelengths actually is responsible for an interesting behavior when they hit the wall from vacuum to a material boundary. They actually see so many nuclei that they are reflected like a wave. That means you can build a trap and the particles can bounce 10,000 times and they are not lost from the volume, okay? So you have optical properties. In addition, the level splitting in a Tesla magnetic field is about comparable to the kinetic energy. That means you can make 100.0% polarization, which is also kind of cool. And you can trap them until they decay, basically. The trap can be open on top because they cannot jump out. They're not fast enough. Okay? So that's how this is measured. This is what the neutron EDM apparatus, the Sussex apparatus, looked like. It's a box where the particles bounce around like this. Yeah? I did this simulation 20 years ago. This is terrible, no? So, and we still didn't do any measurement yet. So this is what the trap looks like. It's half a meter in diameter, 10 centimeters high, and there are two electrodes to apply the electric field, 200,000 volt, and the magnetic field is vertical. Yeah, so the ultra-cold neutrons come in here, are polarized here with Zeeman splitting, so one spin component is repelled, the other one goes inside, fill the box to the equilibrium density, there is a mechanical shutter which is open until there is an equilibrium reached and you close it, magnetic field is vertical, then the Ramsey sequence starts and you empty the particles afterwards again through such a magnetized foil into a detector, so you have a polarization-depending count rate. That's how the fringes are measured. Okay? In addition, there is a second apparatus installed here for Mercury 199 that's used as a nuclear spin polarized vapor for optical magnetometry from here to here. Yeah. So the idea is you compare two species, when it's a cut through the box, these are the electrodes and these are the two substances inside. The idea is when you have in the case of the neutron EDM, this was circularly polarized light, and you look at the absorption of a laser of a Mercury 254 nanometer beam as function of the position of the spins of the Mercury atoms. This is 8 hertz in a micro Tesla field, and the neutrons have 30 hertz. The weird thing is, because the neutrons are so slow, the center of mass is not random in this volume. The center of mass is actually 2 millimeters below the center of the box, so that means that you are sensitive to gradients. So if you apply a vertical gradient, you can actually see the change of the frequency ratio for a B field up or down because of this difference in center of mass of Mercury and neutrons. So if you find this point where there is no where these two curves meet, basically means that there is no gradient, and then you would be sensitive to an EDM. This would be the simplest thing that you can imagine. It's obviously a little bit more complicated. So that's the limit that corresponds to this energy resolution. This is already a long time ago. I always like to quote these numbers. These look much nicer than I mean, this is a really small number. So just because so many people talk about CPT tests, and so of course one can also do CPT tests with such experiments, and this was done. We did this and stopped doing this in 2010. But the idea is the experiment sits on the Earth and is also rotating, so you can look if there's a spin-dependent background field, for example, a standard model extension, then this interaction potential would be varied. That means you would see sidereal or daily modulations depending for what effect you're looking for, and you could also extract limits on this or so, which was done. Then there is a more general thing, and there are people in the audience who are much more familiar with this. So we have also done such an extraction, so, and then the energy scales become immediately very high. Obviously, the low density of the cohabitating species is an advantage because of systematics, because they don't talk with each other, but on the other hand, you don't have the statistics to have a good measurement. Yeah. So, okay, but let's come to the main points a little bit. This is more or less motivating why I had so much time to play with magnetic fields that I'm going to explain. And this is, where do the ultra-cooled neutrons actually come from? You need a reactor. Yeah, this is the Grenoble research reactor. It's a 60 megawatt, a 57 megawatt research reactor, the strongest research reactor that we have. Basically, it's one fuel element. It's a submarine reactor, basically. And next to this, there is in a heavy water moderator a cold liquid deuterium source from which one extracts very slow neutrons vertically upwards in a guide. Yeah. At a certain angle, these neutrons are reflected from walls. The transition to ultra-cold is that if they are reflected from any angle of incidence, they are called ultra-cold. That's the exact definition. Then there's some Doppler shifting method, and then you end up with a density of a order of 10 per cubic centimeter. Now, how efficient is this process? For a flux of 10 to the 15 per square centimeter per second in the core of the reactor, you get the 10 to the minus 13 fraction expressed in, don't worry about the units as a density. Yeah, from a flux. When you have cold neutrons, that means a cold source, this is 70 times more efficient, but this is still not much. Yeah. So what you do is you need to kind of deal with the problem that Liouville is always there. Yeah, you cannot, the phase space density is not easily increased. And the way you do this is you build a so-called super thermal source. This is a material, a solid basically, that converts the cold neutrons to ultra-cold neutrons. Basically, the idea is the neutron couples to a solid and has a degree of freedom where it can give away energy. Yeah? And this is basically you cool this away, so it's an excitation, you cool this away, and then you can actually increase the phase space density, and the main options are deuterium or helium. Deuterium has a big rate of production, but a short lifetime of the particles in the material. Helium is the other option for such a source. It has a less efficient production rate, but on the other hand, you can store the neutrons all the time because helium doesn't absorb them. When the helium is cold enough, there is no phonon upscattering, also it's strongly suppressed, and there's no nuclear absorption. Okay? So all new... Yes?
Very stupid. Why can't you do it with faster neutrons so that you don't lose the step to the minus 13? Because this is gut wrench.
Yeah. So Ramsey started with beam experiments in the 1950s. Yeah. And with beam experiments, you run in the same limits as atomic EDM experiments had with Vickers E effect. The observation time in the beam is relatively short, and you have a systematic which Vickers E is relatively nicely, you can nicely determine this, obviously, but it's an effect which is just, at this level, it's just many orders of magnitude higher than the thing that you look for, so you don't want to make such a big correction. And the idea is to use the long observation time, which more or less compensates for this and is systematically cleaner.
Yeah, but why don't you shoot like the hot neutrons, you say you take cold
neutrons. They won't stay in the box.
But why don't you make the box longer?
It's the observation time. It's the observation time. If the particles are fast, then the observation time is can be a millisecond in, I don't know, tens of meters.
So this cold no, I'm talking about the slowdown. This is where you call the Q-tron beam. So I'm saying that why don't you... No, the beam, of course, you want to make the...
Here. Well, yeah, you can make this larger. There are only practical limitations.
So the practical limitations are coming from the size of the box you can put?
Yeah, for example, for deuterium, it makes no sense to make the box thicker than a centimeter because of this short lifetime and the velocity, the thickness where they can escape from the source is like a centimeter. So there are a lot of practical, this is really an art, and this is also the reason why we didn't get further yet, because all these sources have their own problems. Yeah. So what we are doing at ILL, and I show this a little bit later, is we actually build a 3 meter long helium volume where we use a cold beam. So that means that the beam produces a lot of neutrons on the way. We don't have 3 meters in the beginning, but we can extend it further. Yeah. But it's made in a way that we can use more and more and more. Yeah. But this is only linear. So a good idea would be better than a linear improvement. But
what is the physics for this short lifetime?
These lifetimes here are, well, here it's a mixture of many excitation mechanisms, thermal upscattering that you have in here. This is actually a dominating process. So if it's thermal upscattering and a little bit nuclear absorption and so, but in deuterium you have rotation. This is ortho-deuterium that you need, and if you para, if there's para-deuterium, the lowest lying excitation. So the idea is that in para-deuterium, you immediately have the 7 milli-EV minimum energy, which is just 6 orders of magnitude above the ultra-cold neutron energies. That kind of kills the density immediately. So it's the ortho-para ratio that needs to be high. Nuclear absorption needs to be so. Helium, which is cold enough, is the perfect substance for storing them. Of course, people are all aware of this, and they build a lot of experiments. My God, this looks very full when I look at it now. Don't remember all these things that you see here. So there are different classes of approaches. UCN with boxes at room temperature to trap them, and UCN operated at cryogenic temperatures. This is the American approach. So these are cells filled with ultra-cold neutrons, which are produced by a cold beam already in the volume, so you don't need to transport them. And this whole thing is filled with superfluid helium because below 0.7 Kelvin, this phonon upscattering process is small enough that you can actually trap them. The alternative is to build a box like this with storage cells for ultra-cold neutrons, more than one in the next generation typically, but you have to fill the boxes from outside, from your source. Both things have disadvantages. So they have all, some properties or so we can talk about this. There are many magnetometers for those at room temperature because it's easily accessible. For this or so, one thinks about helium-3 because the idea is to use spin-dependent absorption and let them precess together and use the bit frequency of the absorption and the fluorescence of helium-3 so that you get a light signal as the bit signal. As an internal magnetometer. There are many other ideas, and I just wanted to say that there might be no strong enough UCN source in the future, so at some point we might end up having to use a cold beam again at the pulsed source, like the European spallation source. And there's a paper on this. This is basically Ramsey's experiment just with a pulsed source. Then one can think of a large-scale space-like interferometer, like this what Helmut Rauch did, neutron interferometry, and which I don't think is very suitable for this particular purpose, but mainly for other things. And in the end also, proton EDM tests similar physics. So if at some point we have to be a little bit careful. If you write down 10 to the minus 28 electron centimeters as a goal for all the experiments, then I would bet on the neutron, because this is kind of realistic with the neutrons still to achieve. But after 10 to the minus 28, we need a lot of new ideas, especially for the density of the particles. If you say 10 to the minus 29 as our goal, then I would bet for the proton, because with the neutrons, we just won't reach it. And then at some point, even though the protons are so hard in the experiment or so to deal with, or so they might be faster in the development.
What's the comparison to like Mercury EDM experiments then?
Pardon?
What's the comparison to the Mercury EDM?
This really, I took out all the atomic experiments on purpose. This is a, we can, This is an extra talk if you want. This is probably better if I show the slides or so, the comparison. So there's really actually, this is a longer thing. So if you want, I have actually nice pictures, but digging them out also takes more time. Okay, so we know a lot of problems that we run into. And these are the so-called understood systematic effects. And of those, the most critical one is the so-called Ramsey-Bloch-Seeger shift, or commonly called geometric phase. And geometric phase can be, this is not completely correct, but approximately correct. What you see here is basically there's always a frequency shift coming from transverse magnetic field contributions, like a Bloch-Seeger shift. Also, when you make a spin flip in an NMR experiment with an oscillating field instead of a rotating field, there's always a mistake in the frequency that's induced. And the bad thing is that this comes in with the square. So if your transverse fields contain a contribution from the, this is basically the, this is radius half this alpha, okay? But so if there is a transverse, if there is from divergence B equals zero, so if you have a vertical gradient that has transverse components and an V cross E effect, then you have an interference term which is linear in E. So that means you get a frequency shift which changes sign when you change sign of E. And that's exactly the problem for all these experiments. By the way, in principle, it looks a little bit different, but it's the same for the, proton EDM also has classes of effects of this kind. Yeah. This leads you to the requirements for the magnetic fields. For a proton EDM, it really looks different, I know, but you call it also geometric phase. It's also a, so. If you would like to go to 10 to the minus 28 electron centimeters, you arrive at gradient requirements over the size of your experiment of a fraction of a nanotesla per meter gradient at the field of a microtesla, which for mercury, for example, would be 4 times 10 to the minus 27 false EDM. Yeah, you can actually see this false EDM for mercury as function of gradient for B-field up and B-field down. And these are in units of 10 to the minus 24, and this is something that's easy to measure. Yeah. So this is really terrible. For the neutron, this kind of eats up your error budget. That's approximately what it should be. Yeah. So that means dipoles on the trap surface, like little pieces of dirt, a micron piece of ferromagnetic dust, eats up all your error budget of the experiment. One piece of dust. So you have to do it relatively careful. A micron piece roughly is a dipole within this 5 picotesla in 2 centimeter distance. That's about what you can measure, actually. So it's good. The techniques that we have to analyze our equipment is about that quality. And it needs to be reasonably stable because you don't want to make too many corrections with external magnetometers. There's a lot of literature on this, but the problem didn't get better. So in the next generation of experiments, the really understood problems are these geometric phases. But when you look a little bit closer, you actually find weird things. For example, that's something that a student of mine found 2 years ago. When you look in the, when you go to the rotating frame and watch the spins precess, then they're precessing now. Yeah, B-field is upwards. Spins are precessing in the rotating frame like this. And then you look at the dissipation. Well, some spins are a little bit slower. Some will be a little bit faster. They have motional narrowing in the box, which is, means they sample the volume very quickly and so on. And then you see that after a while, this is a Gaussian distribution, the green line, depending on the electric field or the magnetic field gradient, the particles go away from this Gaussian distribution and take the shape of a so-called Salis distribution. And as soon as this thing has any skewness, you can actually, when you want to see it already now in the Sussex results. But if there's any kind of skewness, your error estimation is wrong. Then of course, what you immediately think is G minus 2 or mu and G minus 2 also affected? And the answer is unfortunately probably not. So we did the simulation, it's very elaborate and it's probably much more harmless. But this would give you a different error bar on G minus 2, by the way. And the system does the same. So as soon as you have such gradients, and they evolve over time, these deviations from the Gaussian shape. Yeah? This is, for example, a new type of systematics that was not considered when the experiments were planned. This was found after the hardware was built of the new things, okay? So, magnetic fields.
Can I ask, sure. Is there an intuition about how to think about this deviation from non-Gaussianity? So how much your error budget increase, for example, this Q parameter that you have here, is the it parameters the deviation, is there,
okay. So there is in principle no consequence as long as the thing stays symmetric. As long as the thing stays symmetric, you just make a slight mistake in the width of the error bar.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's harmless. But as soon as this thing is slightly tilted, for example, in G-2 when your moving system is rotating, yeah, then you would expect that then you make a mistake in estimating the error and upper limit. As long as it's not skewed, it's harmless, but this we don't know yet what will happen. So it just means that there's a new type of issue which is folded to all the systematics that we know. It's not just geometric phase or anything, it's everywhere. Right? It's affected by electric and magnetic things. This is the deviation from the average angle in the rotating system. Sorry, you cannot see this here. What I wanted to say here is that it's even more important to know about your magnetic fields because you cannot switch off the electric fields, but you can switch off the gradients.
Are there echo ways of dealing? Clever echo ways of dealing with these things?
I have no idea.
Okay. Have you clarified
that? Yeah, maybe. Well, now maybe.
Often when we have systematics and clocks, then what we will do is we will, you know, allow this tape to process for some time, and we will do some spin echo.
Okay. And I see what you mean. Yes. Misunderstanding. For other systems, you can do this very nicely, but for these systems, which are at low pressure, the averaging works so well that with spin echo, you do not recover anything. This is the wrong system to do spin echo. If it would be a solid, then this would be perfect to recover everything, anyway. So small fields are important and they're actually easy to achieve. So if you build a box made from magnetic shielding material, and this is, when I talk about fields, I just realized this is the most macroscopic field that has ever been discussed probably in here. This is a box with meters of size with a lot of holes that you can really look into or so. And then it doesn't do a lot of damping. That's a typical frequency, several millihertz. That's a typical time constant of your experiment. So everything that you measure must be matched. All optimum performance in terms of noise and drift must be matched to the typical duration of such a Ramsey measurement. And then you can see that you end up with a few nanotesla. And if you would like to apply a microtesla, this is already quite reasonable, right? It's a percent. So this is for a magnetic field actually not so bad. But of course, it will drift, and this would give you terrible geometric phases or so. This would give you results like the demonstration of the geometric phases that I've shown before with Mercury. And then we started working on better shielding factors. So these are frequencies and shielding factors. That means that the damping of an external excitation to the inside where your experiment is placed. And you put the box there. And then this is what's the commercial limit. So this is what PTB has, 75,000 damping factor, 10 millihertz. This is kind of the reference of the world. And then we started building these things. And our first one was 6 millions and was also relatively steep. But it's only very specific for this one particular experiment. So this is the strongest shielded thing over a large volume that people have built so far. And you can also see the players in the world. There's this BMSR and BMSR2. These are the PTB shields, which are really where you can walk inside and make different experiments. Then this is our shield. And then there is something at Boston Medical Center. And there are some. This is kind of standard. This you find everywhere. So when you measure the shielding factor of a million or so, this is such a shield. There's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 shields and an inner shield, which was for this measurement not installed. Then this is not so straightforward because your signal is damped by 6 orders of magnitude at millihertz frequencies and, I don't know, at 7, 8 orders of magnitude at hertz frequencies. So it's very difficult for a sensor to actually operate there. So we needed different sensors, for example, Mercury magnetometer, Mercury 199, and you see the error bars of the Mercury magnetometer for such long integration times. Yeah. These are a few picotesla here. So these are 10 to the minus 11 tesla here. Yeah. And you see what the squid does over for such time constants. But this is a regime where squids are not suitable. So the magnetometry is really a big deal for this type of experiments because everything drifts on the time scale of a few hundred seconds. Okay, and that's the main challenge. Mercury is particularly nice because this is intrinsically very stable. It doesn't see a lot it doesn't see faster frequency changes because of its limited bandwidth, but it's a very suitable device. So what, in order to just measure this shielding factor, you actually need a setup that provides laser light from stabilized via spectroscopy setup to several different cells. And some pickup diodes and so on. This is a little bit similar to the Mercury EDM experiment from Seattle, and also needs, for example, a quality of the locking the laser light to a false EDM equivalent of 10 to the minus 27. So that means just to measure these things, so you actually spend some time already.
Minus
27. Oh, yes. Yes. This will be much easier. Okay. But for this, you have to demonstrate, for example, that your spin relaxation times are minutes. Yeah? And other things are, for example, that you cannot accept light shifts. These are, you have to tune your laser light in a way that the light, the photons itself don't act as an effective magnetic field on the atoms, basically. Yeah? There's a lot that the laser does at this level of precision. And then you end up with femtotesla precision over such long integration times or so. And it's also a low drift thing. You can see some 8. This is the light shift contribution. And you see that there's a magic point with a magic detuning of Mercury. This is known since Cohen Tanucci, basically, that at 8 megahertz detuning from the resonance frequency, you end up, this is small detuning, a few megahertz, you end up with at the point where the light doesn't cause an extra magnetic field that you measure. Yeah? Then you need to do locking. That means there are a lot of these lines, and you have to play a lot that these lines are steep and so on. And then this is such a raw precession signal. But the cool thing is the magnetometers actually are totally primitive. You shoot the laser on one side in the experiment. It goes free space for 3 meters. And on the other side is a photodiode. And you put some random cell with a little bit of mercury vapor in between, and that's sufficient. Okay, so this is really a gift. Once you have the laser running, that's stable, then this is easy.
I have a very stupid question, but 254 nanometers is usually an annoying wavelength to work with. So why mercury and not a nicer atom or wavelength?
It has many historic reasons for this purpose. You're right, one could use something different. But in the case of mercury, the reason was that it was mainly, it was planned to be used as a cohabitating magnetometer with the neutrons, and the vapor pressure has a very good, is very good and very suitable for this particular type of measurement because you're way below the Paschen minimum for electric breakdowns when you put mercury vapor there, and also from the temperature and so on. This is, it just fits all very well. But for a magnetometer itself, you're right, you could use visible light and you have less losses when you go so long pass through the air, for example. But anyway, so we designed it to be as flexible as possible, and that was the main reason. So then we put everything together for the neutron EDM, and then it was 6 millionths at the millihertz. So this is a lower limit, because we couldn't at some point not resolve it anymore at smaller excitations. And then we could measure how squids behave inside. And you could actually see this is the noise of squids as function of integration time. The last point is not valid. We should have cut this off a little bit earlier. But you see that the squids stay within a few femtotesla over several hundred seconds. This is actually smaller than, I think, than anyone else ever measured this.
Many lines on that, not some much worse than
that. That's true, not every squid is as good. But we could repeat this, and there's always approximately the same sensors are that low. Okay. And these are measured field values in picotesla in typical dimension of the experiment. This is all numbers in picotesla, so this means this is all in the average 100 picotesla or below. This is also kind of one of the smaller fields. And now the question is, where do the fields actually come from? And then it starts getting interesting when we deal with magnetic shielding to understand this. First of all, when you put the magnetic shield together, it consists of pieces and it has mechanical tension. So the residual field that we measure is actually the mistakes that we make in the shield, and you can see this like this from the neutron-antineutron oscillation experiment from 1979. Tubes are connected together, and at the connection you get some stray fields like this. Yeah? So you get rid of those, or so we did some changes in the assembly and so on. This is all straightforward, but the problem is every mistake is expensive. So if you screw up here, it's €1 million. Yeah? So it's simple, but you really have to calculate it. So we actually tried and measured. So for example, this is a door of a magnetic shield, and and the wall of a magnetic shield, so you close it like this. So mu metal sheets are overlapping here, and you actually see the field lines jump out like this at this overlap. And you look at this line, what the field amplitude decreases. And you find something that you basically dislike. So then we started getting rid of the residual fields, and this is called magnetic equilibration instead of degaussing, because the key was to understand it in a way that we don't degauss the material, we actually bring it in an energy optimum or so with the surrounding, so that the field lines don't want to change the domain orientation anymore. Then this fits best. So this is typically achieved by having a sine wave signal with decreasing amplitude. And for example, these are walls of a magnetically shielded room, and these are coils that you wrap around. And you do this for each direction space, that way, that way, and that way. And there are many parameters. This is all straightforward. There's skin depths that you have to consider. There's the frequency, which is a few hertz only, DC offset, some symmetry and shape of the sine waves that you apply. This is all on a level of 24 bit at this point. Yeah. To achieve this. So yes, enough currents, obviously. An increasing slope of the signal in case you know that you don't saturate everything, envelope functions, and so on. Yeah. So then we did some improvements here. Instead of this type, we made L-shaped coil configurations. And then we had, instead of these magnetic fields, these are planes in the shielded room, badly shielded room. Different heights, planes at different heights measured with this regular method and then with this new L-shaped method, and we could see, oops, this is much better, and then we learned something about the saturation. It is also 10 times faster, and this was then commercialized, this particular thing, because this was kind of useful, because this 30 seconds is much more applicable when someone opens and closes a door. And from this, we actually started the real thing that really brought us forward. And this was, we actually did time-dependent simulation of the hysteresis curves. So we really simulated this magnetization behavior point-like. So it's nonlinear on each point. And so you basically increase the currents, decrease the currents. This is such a test geometry. It's a mu metal panel. Yeah, such a snake, which closed circuit and a lot of little coils. And then you look at the overlap of simulation and experiment, and you see that these patterns on top of such a thing quantitatively agree with the experiment. This is totally trivial in principle, but this is actually quite elaborate to get it to work on a quantitative level. Many people actually worked with us on this problem. This has a lot of implication.
Explain us a totally trivial thing. What's the origin of these little patterns in the magnetization?
Non-trivial. So it's just a result of the way we did this. We put these little coils here, and the geometry, and the deformations of the mu metal that originated from laser cutting after annealing or so. So this is something that we basically that we tried to do in the simulation. Model it as good as we could, and we really measured the exact same thing in reality. And the reason why I wanted to demonstrate it that way, it's absolutely not obvious why this pattern emerges from this. I mean, this you cannot see at all, right? So simulation spit out something, and then we made the experiment, it's the same. So that means this is not something, to get such a pattern from such a field, from such a pattern from simulation and measurement, the same way it really means the simulation works. But you're right, I mean, it's in principle trivial, but this particular example is actually much more complicated. Yeah. There's no way to understand this from looking at it. Yes. This has consequences. For example, if you degauss such a shield and you look at the field along such a line, the magnetostatic simulation gives you this result, field as function of distance along this line. And when you do this time-dependent, you actually see that the result is quite different. This makes a huge difference in the end, because your experiments that you build will behave very different. Yeah. Then we did a step further, so we distributed coils and so on. So instead of having coils around the corners, we distributed the coils. Then you can get rid of all the overlaps of the doors and access holes and so on, because you can 45 degrees magnetize them. So you can also get rid of this, and then we built such a box. Yeah, these are the guys who installed it. They had to install it by hand, and it was more than a ton because there was no space for wheels. So this was a lot of new design features and so on. And then this didn't even have such a large damping factor, but the residual field on 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5 meter was less than 25 picoteslas, measured here on this part. This is 80 times 80 centimeters, and if you take this section here, so it's less than 25 picoteslas.
This is at the millihertz. This is to what?
This is more or less static. So this is at millihertz and below. So this doesn't,
Have you looked at how it looks at higher frequencies at all?
Well, there's just noise on it. The shape stays the same.
But the magnitude is exactly the same, or does it go down as you go to higher frequencies?
No, no, this is static field. This is a static field just with noise on it. Yeah, the noise distribution looks a little bit different, but if you average it away at low frequency and then you have a little bit of noise on it, but you don't really see it on that level. So this is, I don't know, a few femtotesla. We can talk about noise later. Yes.
Is this a single layer?
These are 2 millimeters thick, one box, yes. Actually, but it sits in a low field already. So it sits in, I don't know, 100 nanotesla field or something. But I mean, this is kind of an important finding because, first of all, it costs a fraction of what things cost before. This is a factor of 5 cheaper, if you want, than in the past. And the field is just, you know, instead of the PTB room has 1.5 nanotesla roughly on that volume. An average or so, and this is 25 picoteslas, a factor of 60, 70 smaller. So that's the actual advance that we made. So I could stop here. Nah, I have more. But I wanted to tell you then about some measurements that we do in some of these shields, and it's called the HEXA experiment, helium xenon experiment made by many people. I have to admit my main contribution was to administrate it recently. So this is such a cell. It's a GE180 cell with silicon wafers, or so which you apply high voltage. You bring this in from a Siop polarizer into a shielded room with two layers and a radio frequency shield. There is the cell. There's a magnetic field that you can apply, and there's a squid cryostat sitting on top of it. So you watch the free precession of the helium and xenon spins and pick them up with a superconducting coil. Nothing else, okay? Relatively straightforward. It's basically a spin-off from R&D, and that was an undergrad experiment, and it worked actually surprisingly well. And then we could extract some, you know, this is a typical sequence time series of such a beat signal, or such a sequence of helium and xenon processing. This is a few 10 hertz, what you see here. And then you can look at the FFT peaks for the T2 times of the substances. We have now a little bit longer since last year. This is an older plot. And then you can immediately extract an Allen standard deviation. This is now with a squid cryostat of 7 nanotesla per root hertz background noise. This is the frequency uncertainty as function of, or approximately, that's the integration time. It's called an Allen plot. And you see a slope here. So this is xenon alone. This is the co-magnetometer, the red line. And then there's some correction on the co-magnetometer, which we are going to publish at some point or so. Then you can actually see this is one shot. So this is, you know, 1,000 seconds or so. So this is in 1,000 seconds, this is on the order of a little bit more than 1,000 seconds. This is some 10 nanohertz. The T2 time or so is limited by the shape of the cell. If this would be a sphere, this would work better. If this is a cylinder, So then there are many systematics that you look at. And one of the more interesting one is the crosstalk between xenon and helium. So the fact that the substances are polarized means that the frequency of the substance itself is shifted by the magnetization of the substance itself and by the other substance in the cell. Okay? There's always a longitudinal component left of the polarization that you have to take into account. And then you can do things like you watch the xenon frequency as a function of having both spins parallel, antiparallel, parallel, antiparallel, and so on. And then you can actually get different frequencies here, which get closer together with the T2 time, with the decay of the polarization.
But because the cell is not spherical?
No, this is just because of longitudinal components. Yes, the non-spherical shape contributes to this also, but in a more complicated way because of rotations or non-perfect alignment in the B field. But in principle, you always have this because of longitudinal residual components. But here we on purpose tested longitudinal components. So we let it sit longitudinal, and then tested one and the other also. You actually made a point, there are 3 methods how this is determined, and this is not, you cannot understand this from what I told you now. Because This basically means this is the difference if the substances would be parallel or antiparallel. Yeah? And the way you measure this is always that you actually try different flip angles and reconstruct it afterwards. Because otherwise they are never, if they are parallel, they are not precessing, so you cannot measure the frequency. So you do different spin, different angles with the different species and reconstruct it afterwards. It's actually a little bit more complicated.
But I thought that for a spherical cell...
No, it's a cylinder.
Ah, okay.
this was the question, yes. And then the other things, for example, this is directly cell geometry related. So if you vary the orientation of the cell, then you get frequency shifts of the substances. Yeah, these are two different fits. Also. There are many things that one extracted. The reason why it's not published yet is because we are still working on a few of those things. William Terrano actually is doing this. You might know him from some axion papers. This is the sensitivity. Again, it works better the higher the electric field is that we can apply. This works at the bar, so it has very different systematics than neutron EDM. Then it has to do with the measurement time, signal to noise ratio, and the number of repetitions of the experiment. There is an interesting feature here. So first of all, I wanted to say we are better than 10 to the minus 26 at one shot. So that means in 3,000 seconds, each of the measurements is approximately the literature limit. But the idea is to do it better. And this factor 3.5, I thought is kind of funny or so. And the only way I can explain it or so is the fact that the error for a frequency determination goes with tau over minus 3/2 is you can think of the width of the Fourier space. This is the finite time, basically, that you have for your measurement, and the statistical quality of your sample. Because so you have sampling of your signal. So this the time is the number of data points, which is proportional to the time. This goes with 1 over square root of number of data points, and this goes with 1 over tau, and this gives you a factor of 1 over 3/2. I just thought this is kind of for someone who doesn't see these things or so. And this is called Kramer-Rau lower bound, and that's the slope of this curve here. This must be like this. If this is not this curve, then you're doing something wrong. This was the second part of the analysis talk that you skipped, I think, this type of thing. OK, if we would get this squid from PTB, which was published, then we would have almost a factor of 100 sensitivity improvement just by placing the X away and put this there. Okay, we would need it for 3,000 seconds. Okay.
This squid is still reading out the mercury?
No, this squid is a PTB for a test purpose or so.
No, I meant it's not a co-magnetometer.
No, the squid just reads the co-magnetometer signal.
Okay, that's what I meant.
Yeah, so that there are two substances are precessing this is the pickup coil.
Yeah.
Not just the noise of the pickup coil, and you get a factor of 100 almost just by optimizing this. It's not exactly the squid, we would maybe rebuild it a little bit, yes. So talking a little bit about noise, that's something that everything finds interesting. When you look, this is the flux, the noise, flux noise per square root of in femtotesla per square root of hertz, and this is the frequency. And then you see this is outside noise. This is a cheap magnetically shielded room. This is a good magnetically shielded room. And this is the EDM shield here. So the base level is measurement equipment. The baseline is measurement equipment here. And then you see the noise go up. And you see that this room temperature shielding actually has the same quality at this level of precision as a superconducting shield placed inside the BMSR2 in Berlin. So that means this is really competing with superconducting shielding on the level of any squid that you can get. This is really a good one, actually. Just the noise was a little bit too high. And another aspect that I wanted to show you is we can actually see all the Johnson noise from the mu metal, depending on distance and so on. So you can actually read these things, just in case someone is interested from getting the noise levels or so. And this is an amplification of mechanical resonances and the 1 over F corner that you see for these sensors. Yeah. So then. To drifts and noise, when you put the experiment inside the environment, you actually see that the electrodes for the EDM experiment, you can put them on the squid camera and see that there are a lot of features, and then you degauss it, then the features go away, but still they have 20 picotesla in this distance. This is metallic electrode material. And this is just, well, much larger than what we could accept. So that means all the equipment must be non-metallic inside for the next generation. So this makes it really hard, especially for high voltage electrodes. And another thing that I hear everyone is always talking about Johnson noise. But there is a much, much worse thing happening. And this is as soon as you have any type of material inside your shield, then as soon as, for example, every experiment is supported mechanically somehow. Yeah? And the support has a slightly different temperature always. So if there's anything metallic, there's a temperature gradient. For example, you touch this quickly with your finger like this, not more. Okay? Like this. And then the field rises by nanotesla, which is 6 orders of magnitude beyond what you want, and it takes hundreds of seconds to disappear. So this is a type of problem that you get when you have metallic pieces in the experiment.
It disappears abruptly?
Well, I mean, this is when the hand is removed, and yeah. Then it takes hundreds
decays.
Of...
It decays. What
yeah.
happens?
Oh, I don't have the plot is so old that even this is we did this 10 years ago. But I dig this out for this purpose. But it finally comes back after, I don't know, 1,000 seconds or so to the more or less initial level. These are currents due to impurities in metals, and you have this in every wire and so on. It's really a problem on this. With a wire, it's smaller. So to give you an idea, this is like the vacuum chamber of this experiment. It's made from plastic. Yeah. This atomic magnetometers using Dimas design, but in 3D printed plastic holders to support them or so. In general, you know, there's EDM experiments for xenon or so. This is a pieces of wood put together and plastic or so. This is really rather primitive or so. The last point of content that I wanted to make here is that you also have to apply generated magnetic fields inside. This is the B0 coil of the EDM experiment. And this works like this. It's a mu metal cylinder with wires wrapped around the cylinder. Okay? So you magnetize the mu metal from that side and symmetrically from the other side, and the field lines have to go somewhere and they go down in the middle. So it produces a vertical field. That's the way you make homogeneous fields. Would be called a cosine theta coil if not coupled to the mu metal. If it's coupled to the mu metal, people call it magic box. Every helium-3 person knows this usually. Now, the mu is not homogeneous in this material, so that means if you change the mu, because the cylinder sits somewhere on something mechanical, this is sufficient, any mechanical stress just from mounting it, that the field lines are so deformed that simulations don't work anymore. Okay? So that means that it all gets more complicated. When you look here, we are at this is measured at 1.6 microtesla, and we are at a few times 10⁻⁴ relative tilt at the moment over the EDM volume. This is really a lot of work to go there. And it doesn't fit with any simulation because of these effects. So we had to reconstruct all of these things to actually make it fit. Yeah, this takes a year to get this map measured by two people, because one has to sit inside, be locked up, and the other one write down the numbers. No, but the problem is, you have to do this measurement, you have to position a sensor which has a misalignment acceptance of 0.1 millimeter in 1 meter distance. Right? So mechanically placing something on the table doesn't work anymore. Any robot fails because any rotation or so has way too much vibration, so someone has to sit there without eating before, because this is measured, and then and then someone really has to sit there for 2 hours in a piece and actually move the sensor and always go with calibration points and so on to get these measurements done. So this is terrible work. You know, we are the first ones who built this apparatus, but everyone will have to do this of the others on the list. I hope they are smarter. So applications are, for example, magic boxes. Like we are building, participating in an experiment for the space station where they need such a box that produces a homogeneous field, and we couple it to the mu metal directly on purpose. Yeah, here, then it looks like this or so. There are a lot of correction coils, but the idea is to use the mu metal on purpose. What I learned is everything which is cuboid can be assembled in a way that the simulation fits afterwards. Everything that's kind of spherical or rounded doesn't work from mechanical stress, and you cannot simulate it anymore. So, as a practical advice, build a box, not a.
Quite homogeneous. What are your field gradients?
They can be made almost zero. That's the nice thing about this.
Like when you say almost zero, is it like nanotesla per centimeter? What is your unit?
Small is a picotesla per centimeter.
Picotesla.
Yes. So then, this is an atomic fountain for the University of Hannover, which I'm involved building or so, which is an octagon. The hope is to make this better than the existing ones. Also, again, here, in order to demagnetize it really properly, so it's made from flat pieces without mechanical tension. This is a thing that has to do with the proton EDM, and Yannis was done a while ago, so this is also an octagon and a cylinder inside, and you can actually see these are 2 1-millimeter shields, and you end up with on the order of a nanotesla inside along the center line or so, this volume or so, which is kind of so. And yeah, so okay, so the last part of my talk, I wanted to tell you that our EDM apparatus that stands in our lab now since several years finally got a perspective. We can actually move to ILL in 3 weeks to an ultra-cold neutron source, which is just being assembled and should have UCN in spring next year. And we want to start measuring in less than half a year. And this is the first time I believe such a thing when I say it since 10 years. So this is a double chamber experiment. It has magnetometers on top and bottom. We are not going to use co-magnetometers because the co-magnetometer decreases the electric breakdown strength and decreases the spin precession time and has much higher false effects than our ultra-cold neutrons inside. While we were waiting, we were growing frogs. Maybe someone else talks about the are you still measuring? No. Okay, so Dima is confirming this. The idea is it looks like frogs don't grow in zero field, but they grow in Earth field. That's a topic. No, this is really not a joke. This was a lot of work, and if you want, also, it was actually serious work done, also together with professional people, and it could be that life could be at the sweet spot for in terms of magnetic field.
Do
also,
do you understand why frogs need magnetic fields to? Doesn't
no, there's no reason. No one knows why. That's why Dima should confirm it first. Then we publish.
Just the optics here. Why am I supposed to notice those two pictures?
Those look normal. They had a coil wrapped around. Uh-huh. And those don't look normal. They are kind of crippled. So when you zoom in, they look like this. And the difference is that the field applied here is this is zero field and this not. There's also a point in between. So there are 3 points and it's actually a slope.
So it's a constant slope, or is it happens
if there's
a sharp transition?
We have 0, 1, and 50, so it's not, but between 0 and 1 is, between 0 and 1 is, so it's more like this, so I think. But I mentioned the Nyquist theorem before, it's...
I thought about
it's a topic for later, but it's actually quite interesting. What I wanted to point out, the EDM experiment was actually chosen after an open call for experiments for this new source at the ILL, and we won this call. So we get our own beamline at ILL for the experiment for 6 years now. And the spectrum is very soft, and this already has a demonstrated density of 220 per cubic centimeter. So that means we can actually do a reasonable measurement, and we get an upgrade of the source, which is just being installed. Okay? This is what the source looks like. It means we have to do a large amount of changes to the apparatus, but it's all working in the way that things get smaller, so we can implement it. Yeah, the other way would not work. To go from a deuterium source like at a reactor to helium means that you have to shrink your volumes because the amount of UCN is fixed in helium because you accumulate them in the production and then dilute them into your experiment. Okay? So the reach is shown here, stage 1 and stage 2. In stage 1, we have a sensitivity of a few times 10 to the minus 27 and then a few times 10 to the minus 28 in stage 2. This is less realistic. This is really realistic this time, especially because we won a factor of 3 in density recently because we found a trick here.
What sets the difference between realistic and unrealistic? What do you think about
this? This is stage 2. That means the source is upgraded and we have many more neutrons. And... but this means that we have to upgrade our apparatus in a way that we can use it. You know, and this is not clear that we can actually do this. I mean, of course we can do this, but this is again one of these extrapolations that one has to be more careful with. This is something that we basically have built already. Yeah. This is what it looks like. We move the shields and everything here in 3 weeks from now to ILL. And with this, I'm done. Sorry for taking too much time. I just wanted to say a little bit about small fields. These are really important because a lot of systematics, and I think the most important systematics that we are aware of, depends on these small fields. Therefore, it's really, to some extent, worth investing a lot of time in those things, even though you don't get a Nobel Prize for it, like if you discover an axion. The small magnetic fields are being more important in future for other experiments. For example, proton EDM, but we just realized that the first people just came to us asking from industry, because feature size of 7 nanometers in microprocessor manufacturing with electron beams require magnetic shields of cylindrical shape with a few meters height, which is similar to what atomic physicists like. Yeah. This is neutron EDM. Yeah. So we have a perspective to do our neutron EDM measurement, and we are actually moving there, and the hexa-EDM experiment, the xenon or so, is also much better understood by now, because we actually had a very good person working on this since quite a while, also, and it's really at the competitive level. Yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Because I thought that they already have close to 100 or something.
Yeah. This is this is the slide from Triumph from that I got from Rüdiger Picker, but the 100 or so, I don't know what they have, but this is nothing that people have in the EDM cells. This is all source densities. So these are EDM cell densities. This is a big difference, because that means these are numbers that after being polarized and after being transported, and those are massively smaller usually. Because the PSI source actually has a specific feature. It's a deuterium source, but the number of UCN is fixed. So that means when you transport them, you dilute the whole thing. So it has the disadvantage of the helium source, if you want, in terms of filling your experiment, and the disadvantage of the deuterium source in the spectrum.
Thank you. Another very good part. your hexa. By the way, you might want to translate
what
hexa means in German.
Which? I didn't show the logo, but actually. Yeah.
It means a witch in German. Oh, really? My question is, there is also an ongoing experiment. It's a mind healing experiment.
They might be comparable, but the goal was, so we always intended to use high pressures, because it was just a magnetometer spin-off, not really a dedicated measurement, and they started with very low pressures, so they had millibar pressures for systematics reasons, and now I think they also have high pressures, so it might be more or less the same at some point. Yeah. So it's actually quite, one could exchange more if wanted.
You tell us that your simulations, you preferred plates to, for example, a cylinder. What's the reason that you can't do the simulations for this sort of round format rather than
No, but the simulation is much easier when you use a cylinder, but the problem is that the mu is not homogeneous, so the realistic component that stands in front of you doesn't behave anymore as it's simulated, because of mechanical tension and twist and whatever. And as soon as you have the more cuboid the assembly is, the more likely it is to behave exactly as an ideal geometry, like the simulated one. And this is not only, so it's the advantage of building a box is not just that you can simulate it better, but that really the performance is much better in the end. This is really something that we've seen many times now. This is, one would think that the cylinder is always better, but for specific things, also a cylinder is not better. Right? If you couple it with fields and you have specific requirements, it can be that this is not better or so. But this is not physics, this is a practical reason. Yeah.
For a long time, people didn't understand why their UCN sources weren't performing as they expected. Is that now understood what was going on, and is that partly why you're doing much better?
The helium sources give the numbers that you calculate. And the deuterium they do when you make such a small test. I was actually involved in an experiment when I was still a student. We did such a small cube of deuterium where we produced UCNs, and the production rate is actually what you have on paper. But when you scale it up, it doesn't. So this is only technical, so engineering reasons only. But in helium, the nice advantage is that scaling is much easier because it stays a liquid. In the deuterium, you have a lot. Deuterium changes when you freeze it at 18 Kelvin and you cool it down to 6, it changes its size by 10%. So that means the crystal gets a lot of cracks, and then you have a lot of this small angle scattering inside, basically, on the surfaces because of the refractive index. And this is one of the many reasons also that where it's much harder to technically to do it. I was part of the PSI UCN source as a student. I also thought it would work. Yeah, I think this is just not that easy.
More questions? What made you think of growing the frogs?
So, now, if you all feel as hot as I am, then maybe we should discuss this outside somewhere.